Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Much has been written about the Manhattan Project of World War II and the work of the physicists like Robert Oppenheimer, who worked with others to create atomic weapons, and about Los Alamos, the created town on a high New Mexico plateau, secretive where the work was created. But a lot less has been written about the other sites of the project. Oak Ridge, Tennessee, for example, known today as Atomic City, was where the uranium for the bomb was processed and still has a lab to this day. In fact, the labs there were just as secretive. The town was created in the same way virtually overnight, but staffed by men and women who largely didn't know what they were working on due to compartmentalization. In many cases, they were newly graduated high schoolers or collegians with science degrees, and the workforce consisted of more women than men. In fact, my guest today has written a very interesting book about Oak Ridge and about the women who worked in Oak Ridge. The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II, is the name of the book. Denise Kiernan is my guest. She is the author of two previous books on the stories of the men who signed the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. She's written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Village Voice, and others. The Girls of Atomic City is published by Simon & Schuster. Denise Kiernan, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on.
After doing two books on what happened to the signers of the Declaration of Independence and from the Constitutional Convention, it seems like a very different book. How did you first get interested in the story of Oak Ridge, Tennessee?
I stumbled across it, actually. In many ways, it was sort of dumb luck. I came across a picture of an old black and white photo that showed these young women sitting in front of these enormous industrial panels that were covered in all these crazy knobs and dials and gauges, and they looked so young, and they had those adorable little 1940s hairstyles, and I was just fascinated by the photo, and the accompanying text said these young women, many of them recent high school graduates from rural Tennessee, were enriching uranium for the world's first atomic bomb, only they didn't know that at the time. And I was totally floored. That was all it took. And then I realized that Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where these women were living and working during World War II, was only about 2 hours from my home by car. So I just hopped in the car and went on over there.
And of course, I've been through Oak Ridge one time, and there's very few vestiges of what must have been an incredible security apparatus during World War II around now.
There are and there aren't. The Oak Ridge National Lab is a huge research facility there, and that is out in the area where the X-10 plant, one of the original plants from World War II, was located. But that area looks very different now. Within the town itself, you can see remaining structures from the World War II era, from that era of Oak Ridge's birth, really. But some of it's kind of hidden in plain sight. I mean, a lot of the houses that are in town date back to World War II, but they look different now because, you know, they have porches or driveways or things of that nature, but there are still some sites that you can go visit and drive by, at least. But it does look very different than it did in World War II, for sure.
Now, there are lots of books about life in Los Alamos. That's the other major created town during the Manhattan Project. But I don't think I've ever read much about Oak Ridge. Why has there been so little written about Oak Ridge?
I think for most of us, when we have heard the story of the Manhattan Project, it has been told in a very top-down kind of manner. It's been told from the perspective of the great physicists, the Nobel Prize-winning scientists, these great scientific minds, and also from the perspective of decision makers like General Groves and people of that sort. And that is the way the story has been told, and we do that in history a lot. You know, we talk about the big names when we look back. And I thought there were just thousands and thousands of not just women, but, you know, men as well who worked on this project, and they were just, you know, ordinary people caught up in an extraordinary set of circumstances. And those really are, I know those are the kinds of stories that I enjoy reading. So I wanted sort of Oak Ridge to kind of get a little bit more of a moment. And actually, though we all associate Los Alamos most directly with the Manhattan Project, Oak Ridge was the administrative headquarters for the entire project and was the most populous site of all the Manhattan Project sites. So it really was just a key location as far as the project was concerned.
Well, what was the division of labor between Los Alamos and Oak Ridge? Los Alamos was where the theoretical physicist and the physicist, J. Robert Oppenheimer, I guess they wanted them even further remote.
Yes.
So that could possibly get in there and find the secrets. And what was interesting is they knew what they were working on. A lot of people in Oak Ridge didn't.
Oh, the vast majority of people in Oak Ridge did not know what they were working on. In fact, the vast majority of people working on the Manhattan Project didn't necessarily know what they were working on. But yes, in Los Alamos, they knew, not all of them, but you know, most of the key figures we know about, they knew what was going on. What was happening in Los Alamos was the design and testing of a physical bomb itself. They were actually designing and testing methods for creating the actual bomb. What was going on in Oak Ridge was fuel. Oak Ridge's entire purpose was enriching the fuel that would go into the bomb that was being designed in Los Alamos.
As you got into the story, now Oak Ridge, like Los Alamos, was basically created during World War II. What was Oak Ridge like prior to the war? Was there even a little settlement there?
That area, you're right, it was a purpose-built town. Oak Ridge was not an existing town that was repurposed during World War II. Oak Ridge, or Site X, as it was referred to early in the Manhattan Project, did not exist prior to 1942. What did exist in that area were very small communities, rural communities, and a lot of people were moved off of their land to make way for the project. So before Oak Ridge, there were tiny communities like the community of Elza, and one of the gates in Oak Ridge was named after that community. And there was a community called Wheat, and there were these tiny communities and a lot of very small scale kind of subsistence level farmers. But they had to move, you know, close to, I think it was around 1,000 families off of their land to make way for the project.
Now, again, at Los Alamos, it was physicists, it was PhDs. Here at Oak Ridge, a lot of the work, and I mean, there were probably PhDs, there were PhDs
sure.
there as well, but there was an awful lot of people just out of high school, chemists, ordinary people that were sent to Oak Ridge. What was the general story of most of these people, how they ended up at Oak Ridge?
There were just a wide variety of ways you might end up there. Some people were transferred from other parts of the country where they were already working at government jobs, and they were told, you know, there is a new project. We can't tell you exactly where it is, but, you know, we would like for you to come down and work for the project. That's one way you might get there. If you were a chemist just about to graduate university, the project had ways of kind of locating. They were in touch with a number of academic programs across the country trying to identify potential workers to work in the more science-related areas. So you might have been identified through your university. Some people were recruited right out of the halls of their high school. One of the women that I profiled, but that's exactly what happened to her. She was a senior in high school. A recruiter came to visit and, you know, gave her a very, you know, a test, asked her if she was interested in going to this town that had no name that she could give her yet and, you know, working on this project that would be important to the war. And that's how she was recruited. And, you know, construction, there was a huge need for construction workers because this was a town that, you know, like I said, didn't exist prior to 1942. And by mid-1945 had 75,000 people living there and was using more electricity than New York City. So recruiting for construction workers, they would, anywhere they could find them.
Now, you focus your book on some of the women of Atomic City, as Oak Ridge is still known as. Was it a pretty evenly divided workforce between women and men? Do you think if there's a war on, every able-bodied man is heading to either the Far East or Europe?
Exactly. The majority were women. There were men there. There were also soldiers. If you were a soldier with a scientific background, you might have been recruited into something called the SED, the Special Engineer Detachment. And this was a unit that was, you know, specific to the Manhattan Project. And there were young men ready to be shipped out to go, you know, to the Pacific or go to the European theater. And they were literally taken out of line, you know, with their duffel bags and handed phone numbers and train tickets and said, you know, get on a train, you're going to get off in Knoxville and you're going to call this number, you've been reassigned. And that's all they would be told. So there were men, there were soldiers, there were many women, though, because as you said, this was a moment in our country's history where work opportunities for women were really just expanded exponentially, and that was very true on the Manhattan Project as well.
Now, what was interesting is, as you write in the book, and you told us earlier, most of these women did not know what they were working on. They're enriching uranium, and they don't know they're working. They're working with a product, what do they call it, tube alloy?
It depended on what you were doing. I mean, some people were working more closely with it, if you were a chemist in a lab, perhaps, and some of those people called it tube alloy, some of those people called it product. But there were plenty of jobs involved in the enrichment of that uranium where people had no idea what the final, what the larger picture was. For example, the key to all of this was compartmentalization of work, compartmentalization of training. So, for example, one of the women in my book inspected pipes. She inspected pipe welds for one of the plants that was going to be enriching uranium. All she was trained to do was inspect pipe welds. She was trained very well how to do that. But, you know, a pipe would be brought to her by a millwright. She would inspect it, send it along its way if all the welds were good, mark it if some of the welds appeared, you know, were leaky. And that was it. So she didn't know. She would joke with me. She'd say, you know, what's behind that door over there? Pipes. What's behind that door over there? More pipes. You know, where are they coming from? Where are they going to? I don't know. And you were not supposed to ask. Now, these pipes were key to the enrichment process, but she didn't know that. All she knew was, I have to inspect these welds. So that was one of the key elements to maintaining secrecy and keeping people unaware of what they were working on, was not giving them an ounce of information that they did not absolutely need in order to do their job effectively.
Now, how did you find these women that you interviewed? I mean, they have to be, 80s now?
Let's see. Katie is 96 now. Celia is 94. Wow. The youngest is about to turn 88. That's my youngin. The youngest woman is about to turn 88. I got very lucky that I lived close by. I drove over to Oak Ridge. I was introduced to, you know, and told people at the, you know, local historians and people of that nature that I was, you know, looking for folks to interview. And the first person I interviewed was a 101-year-old man who was a supervisor in one of the plants and supervised a lot of the women. He's in that first picture I saw that got me hooked on the story. And while I was in the lobby of his assisted living center, I met Colleen, the pipe inspector. Mm-hmm. And it's every person I met introduced me to two others or invited me to coffee, or I went to Historic Preservation Association meetings. You know, I would sit in the assisted living center and just stalk octogenarians and ask them if they'd worked, you know, during the war. But most people were very enthusiastic about introducing me to other people who had worked there and lived there during World War II. So it was really kind of a one thing led to another, and the circle expanded that way.
What's interesting is most of these people still live in Oak Ridge, they stayed in Oak Ridge, even though it was far away from home. It was where their job was. And how many of them had jobs once the Manhattan Project was completed?
I think the ones who were there, who stayed, were ones who either had a job left that was going to be available to them or had married someone who had a job there. Some people did leave. Actually, today, Oak Ridge's population is around 27, 28,000. So it's, you know, it's much less than it was at the end of World War II. But there were jobs that remained. And, you know, if you had a good job, I mean, this was, you know, the early 40s. The Depression was a pretty recent memory. And, you know, if you had a good job, you didn't leave it. Now, if you had a better job waiting for you back home, wherever you were, many people wanted to go home to be there to, you know, welcome, you know, their brothers and their sons and people like that back home when the war was over. But for those who had, you know, relationships with people with jobs or jobs of their own, it was worth it for them to stay. And so there is a large community there that, you know, they were the original Oak Ridgers.
Well, tell us some of the personal stories, like Celia, I think it's Sapska. She was a secretary who, how was she approached to go to Oak Ridge?
Celia's story is, I love Celia's story. She was working as a secretary. She was already working for what would eventually be called the Manhattan Project, though she didn't know that. She just thought she had a nice government job through the civil service, and, you know, she went to work every day and did secretarial things. So one day her boss gets a hold of her and says, "We're moving our offices. You've done a great job. We'd love for you to come with us. You know, are you willing?" And she said, "Well, where are we going?" And he said, "I can't really get into specifics about that, but it's going to be in the South." She goes, "Okay, what am I going to be doing?" "Well, pretty much the same thing you're doing, but, you know, that might change a little depending." "Okay?" And she says, "So, if I don't know where I'm going, how am I going to get there?" And he said, "Oh, well, a car is going to come pick you up at your sister's apartment." She was living with her sister and her husband. "Car is going to come pick you up, take you to the train station. We'll have everything taken care of, tickets and all that sort of stuff. And then someone will tell you to get when it's time to get off the train. And then someone else will be there to tell you where you go next." And so she packed, got a new dress and packed up a bag and off she went. And I find that kind of spirit of just sort of going off into the unknown really quite inspiring. And when you consider that this was 1940, this was a young woman in 1943, it's rather remarkable.
Hmm. Now that sounds very familiar to a lot of the stories that came from Los Alamos. You know, they knew they were off on a big government project. Maybe the wife didn't know anything what was going on. It was like, okay, we're moving. You're going to get on a train. And you get off the train, and there you are. Tell us about somebody like Katie Strickland, who you mentioned was the oldest survivor. She was a janitorial service worker.
She was, and she and her husband, Katie and her husband, were African American. They lived in Alabama, and her husband found out about construction work in Oak Ridge from his brother, because they were so desperate for construction workers, they were looking all over the South, and his brother reported that there was a lot of work and that it paid much better than anything they were seeing where they were. And so Katie's husband inquired about jobs for her, and there were janitorial jobs. Oak Ridge was segregated, so there was separate housing, and if you were a black worker, you could only work in construction, janitorial, or as a in the domestic force for some of the people who lived in the houses. You weren't allowed to do anything else. But he went back, and he told Katie, he said, "There's really good work here, and it would be so much more money than you're making." And so she decided to join him there. And the very difficult thing for Katie was, because they were black, they were not allowed to bring their children with them.
Wow.
And so she had to leave her children behind with her mother. And it just, you know, it just broke her heart. And she sent, I mean, they sent, but they were constantly sending money back to Alabama. But Katie still lives there. She still lives there. I saw her just a couple weeks ago.
My guest today is Denise Kiernan, a historian and writer and the author of The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things you do in the book is you write the book much from the perspective of the women we're learning about as these people either come to Oak Ridge, or, you know, for some it was a very short journey. They were from Tennessee to begin with, others from around the country and from around the region. They come to Oak Ridge, this muddy town just think of creating a town from scratch the main work is about the work, not creature comforts. So you can imagine what the town was like. And you don't know what you're working on. And you keep a structure through the book that we know it's about the atomic bomb because of the Girls of Atomic City. But in the course of the book, you sort of tell the story as they were living the story. They really didn't know what they were working. They might get a little glimpse here and there. They might have an inkling. But for the most part, they were, as you mentioned, compartmentalized and really didn't know what they were doing. They just knew it was going to help the war effort.
That's right. And I wanted to maintain that compartmentalization in the structure of the book as well. so the sections that are about kind of the big picture of the Manhattan Project, what was going on behind the scenes with the development, I wanted that in there because I knew for some people this might be the only book they ever read about the Manhattan Project, and I thought it was important for them to understand the overall picture. But I didn't want that to be a part of the sections that were about the women. I wanted the reader to feel as though they were in that person's life and really seeing the entire experience through their eyes. So yes, the book in many ways is compartmentalized just as the project itself was.
You know, when you think of a creative person working on something, you would think of a great deal of frustration in not knowing what you were actually working on. Did you ever sense that from the women? Or we have to remember, we've never been as united as we were after Pearl Harbor. Everybody
That's
knew
right.
that there was a war on. Quit bellyaching. There's a war on. That was, you know, that
yeah.
was sort of a mantra of that particular time. Because of that situation, they just put aside those natural frustrations. What did you find?
I think you've hit on it to a great extent. For a lot of this, when I go give talks about this, people say, but why did they go off and do something that no one would tell them about? And I would say it because it was World War II. And it's hard for people who did not live through it to understand what a unifying cause that war was. Everyone knew somebody who was gone. Everyone knew somebody who was away fighting. And even if you weren't away fighting, at home there were gas rations and sugar rations and meat rations and coupons for everything you could want to buy, and factories everywhere were stopping making whatever it was they normally made, whether it was, you know, pots and pans or whatever, and started making things to support the troops. So there was this, you know, every song on the radio was about the war. The movies were about the war. It was everywhere. And everybody wanted to do their part. So when people were told, you are going to be working on an important project that is going to help the war, but we can't tell you what it's about, most people thought, that's fine with me. I want to do my part. And if this is what it means, this is what it means. Now, I think the more you, in a way, I think the more you knew, the harder it was to kind of keep your curiosity at bay. I think it was the people who were actually working in some sort of scientific capacity, but who were not in the know, I think for them it was probably the most frustrating, but not so frustrating that they were, very annoyed by it. I think it's just kind of it wears on you to do the same thing every day, day in and day out, and you're working toward a deadline that you're being told is very crucial, but you're also not being told when that deadline is or, you know, what the end of your work might look like. And so for that reason, I mean, one of the things that they did for the sake of mental, you know, kind of mental health and trying to keep people as happy as possible was they started creating all of these recreation programs because this was a town that operated 24 hours a day. Shifts went around the clock. So they wanted people to be able to have fun when they weren't working. So there were dances and bowling leagues and basketball and putt-putt and all of this sort of stuff all day long, all week long, to help alleviate some of that stress of working so hard on a project you don't know anything about.
And as a matter of fact, many of the women you met found their husbands at Oak Ridge.
That's right. Well, it's, you know, you have a community that has just sprung up out of the mud. So there was definitely this sort of shared pioneering spirit among the people who found the site sort of exciting and adventurous. And also you had a bunch of young single women and a bunch of young single men going to dances three times a week. So, you know, there were bound to be lots of marriages and babies and all of that sort of thing. So it really helped the community take off. The sort of restricted circumstances, I think, actually moved that along.
Oh, yeah, you're isolated. You can't even leave if you wanted to.
Oh, no, you can leave. You could leave, but to get back in, you had to have your badges and all of this sort of stuff, and your gas was rationed, and so they wanted people to stay as much as possible. They wanted to have everything there as muddy and kind of crazy as it was, They wanted you to be able to, you know, live there, eat there, and, you know, have a good time there whenever it was possible.
Once they found out what they were working on, which for many, some of them, it was when the bomb was dropped, what was the reaction? How do they think about it now, 60 years later?
That depends. I mean, there are some people who, you know, it's in many ways, it's the same kind of variety of opinion you might expect from, you know, any sort of section of the population. What I tried to do in the book was show how these people really lived in two worlds. They lived in a world without nuclear weapons, and they lived in a world with nuclear weapons. I don't know what that's like. My whole life, I've always, I mean, I have an entire lifetime of understanding of what nuclear weapons are. I mean, they lived in a world that there was no such thing as a fallout shelter. There was no such thing as radiation sickness. There was no such thing as nuclear winter. And a lot of those aspects became clearer over time. The majority of people found out what they were working on when the bomb was actually detonated over Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. And the first wave of news, if you got it, because remember, no TV, so you either got hold of a newspaper or you heard it on the radio or somebody told you. And if you were in a plant working, you found out much later than other people. The first wave of information was just about, you know, it was sort of like a big war development. There was this attack, and it's this new weapon, like no other weapon anyone has ever seen, and you know, before. And so that was the first wave of information. But then when Truman gave his address, he actually mentioned by name Oak Ridge. And that's when everybody was just floored, because they thought, oh my gosh, we had something to do with this new thing, whatever it is. That was a lot of information for people to process. And at the same time, even though the big secret was out, meaning Oak Ridge had something to do with this, he didn't go into specifics about what Oak Ridge was doing, many of the specifics remained a secret for years, because a lot of the processes and things were top secret. So what was interesting is a lot of people still didn't find out kind of, you know, what they were doing until years later.
Hmm. You know, you spent so much time with this project, meeting these women who uprooted their lives, worked on this top secret project. What is the significance of the story today? You know, Oak Ridge has a laboratory still, but it's not a secret place anymore. What's your takeaway?
This was a watershed moment in history, not just in American history, in world history. The development of atomic weapons, of atomic nuclear energy, of nuclear medicine, these are all factors that continue to impact our social, political, economic landscape today. And, you know, you can draw a line straight back from, you know, developments you read about in the newspaper, straight back to those girls in Tennessee. And I think when you're talking about a development as significant as this, it is crucial to look at it from as many perspectives as possible, including the perspectives of, as I like to say, of those ordinary people that found themselves in extraordinary circumstances.
Why do you suppose there's been so many books about what happened in Los Alamos and so little about what occurred in Oak Ridge?
I think in general the bigger names always tend to get the lion's share of attention. I think that's really a lot of it. The people who had won Nobel Prizes, the people who were going to be in the news more, I think that's kind of just the way things often shake down, not just in this situation, but, you know, in many others.
The name of the book is The Girls of Atomic City. Denise Kiernan, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Writer Denise Kiernan speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book is titled The Girls of Atomic City, The Untold Story of the Women Who Helped Win World War II. It's published by Touchstone and Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.